Looking Deep is a podcast that seeks to understand varied and unique perspectives about life for our audience and our planet. We operate under the ethos of no judgment, only leaving space for understanding, in the hopes that in learning about the lives of others, we uncover a deeper truth for ourselves. Looking Deep is hosted by Kareem Watermore and is followed by an after show featuring Julia Chatwin. Thank you for joining us, and let the show begin. Hey, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Looking Deep with Kareem Watermore. I have a very special guest today. You know, my godkids got me into this new thing called TikTok. And on TikTok, we see lots of dances, but my algorithm has been a little bit different. And my algorithm pointed me to Dr. Tracy, who has a fantastic TikTok where she talks all the things about coronavirus and how it's transmitted and about efficacy of vaccines. And I found it very, very, very helpful. And hopefully, you know, you can go, if you're on TikTok, follow Dr. Tracy. I think she'll give you her handle sometime in this podcast. So I want to welcome Dr. Tracy to the podcast. Hey, Dr. Tracy, how are you?
Hey, thank you, Kareem. I appreciate this opportunity.
And so can you tell me a little bit about your background and how you are qualified to talk about things issued to virus and coronavirus in particular?
Sure. I have a PhD in microbiology and immunology from a medical school, and I've always been interested, and my research kind of veered away from immunology, but then I started teaching at a local university, and I teach microbiology and immunology there. So I have grown my love of immunology through being a college professor.
Fantastic. So I'm just going to get right into it. So what is coronavirus? What is COVID-19 in particular?
So it's kind of interesting to start with like the semantics of all of this, because I think that's where we're really confused. Coronavirus is one of a family of viruses, is a family of viruses. So it's a very broad category. And the reason they're called coronaviruses is because they all have these proteins on the surface that make them look like they have a crown when you see them in an electron microscope. SARS-CoV-2 is the virus that is particularly causing this pandemic. And when it infects you, sometimes it makes you ill, often. And when you get ill, the disease is COVID-19. And COVID-19 stands for Corona, C-O-V, virus, V-I, disease, D for disease, COVID. And it happened in 2019, and that's where COVID-19 comes from. But that is really the disease. That's when you have symptoms and you feel sick. Not every time that you get an infection from SARS-CoV-2 do you feel sick. Those are called asymptomatic infections. And so that's kind of a background problem where you can still have virus in you, still be shedding virus, but not have symptoms or frank disease.
Mm. And talking about COVID-19, you mentioned it was discovered in 2019. How was it discovered? Is it a naturally occurring phenomena for new diseases to pop up?
Yeah, actually, it's a very natural phenomena. This is a jump, if you will, from an animal, in this case, a pangolin or a bat, and those animals carry coronaviruses. All mammals carry coronaviruses. We all have them. They're in each different species has their own suite of them. And because they're similar enough, sometimes they can mutate in the bat, in this case, and be capable of infecting us. And if they infect us and make us ill, that's one thing, but then they have to have another mutation that allows us to spread the virus to other humans. And so this particular virus jumped from bats, was able to infect our cells, make us ill, but also be spread between us. And that makes it not necessarily special, but this doesn't happen. It doesn't happen all the time, but it happens frequently. And a lot of our viruses have been zoonotic, which means that they've come from other animals. And so this is quite common occurrence in terms of the mechanism by which it happens. And we keep seeing them over and over again, and we will see them in the future. This is not going to stop anytime soon. But this particular coronavirus came in from bats and in Wuhan, China, and it was probably a wet market. There's a team of scientists right now that are in China trying to get to the bottom of exactly where it came from. And I first saw the first blush of this in really late December, early January. And they were talking about this virus circulating in Wuhan, and they were concerned about it because it was making people very ill. it seemed to be spreading pretty quickly. And so then that's when it sort of came on the WHO radar. And we started talking about it in this country, probably the first couple of weeks in January. And really by February, March, was it like this was going to be a big deal. And by March, we were shut down. So,
yeah. And I hate to ask this question, but, you know, people do ask it. Is there any way that by the nature of disease that this could have been created in a lab?
Is there that's a super fair question. It's not, you don't have to hate to ask a question. It's a fair question because people are really concerned that somebody with the knowledge could start mucking about in the genetics of these viruses and start changing them to be, you know, weapons or whatever. In this particular case, and this is true for a lot of things, we don't have to engineer things that are deadly to us. We've been experiencing them for our entire evolutionary history. But in this particular case, we can actually show with very definitive evidence that this virus came from a bat or a pangolin, not from the lab. So there's several lines of evidence that support this. The first is that the most closely related viruses are bat viruses, not human viruses. And if someone were to design a human transmissible virus that's dangerous, they would have started with a virus that already infects humans. So that's evidence number one and two, actually. The second or third piece of evidence is that when we engineer things in the lab, we leave fingerprints, genetic fingerprints in the genome because we're sloppy and that's how genetic engineering works. You can't make it so that we don't see those fingerprints in the genetic material. There are no fingerprints in this genetic material. So that's another line of evidence. And the other thing is that the changes, the mutations that happened between the bat and us is something that would have never been thought of by a human to make this change to get it to infect humans. In other words, we can't predict what changes are going to allow the virus to bind to our cells. We can't figure that out. And this particular mutation was just a random change. And that change was something that was unknown before. We'd never seen it. And now suddenly it binds to our cells. And now we're like, oh, okay. So it's a beautiful happenstance that these changes all came in the virus. And humans, while we're very smart, we're not that smart. And it's just, it wouldn't have happened through the lab. So there's a lot of evidence to suggest that this is definitely just a normal zoonotic disease that happened to get into humans in Wuhan, China. And there just happens to be a virology lab in the same town. That's like saying, oh, something happened in San Francisco. And because there's a biotech, it's just coincident that the Chinese government, the Chinese virology lab is there.
Oh, fantastic. And so let's get into the virus itself. What makes this COVID-19 especially dangerous that we have to have lockdowns and practice things like social distancing, et cetera, that we have to stay home? What makes it so dangerous?
Well, so one of the things that's really important to recognize about infectious disease is that you want to control the virus spread as much as possible, but things like influenza, there's a subpopulation that has seen most of influenza viruses out there. So they're going to always be resistant to the virus. But here, this is a brand new virus. So the entire population of the earth is potentially susceptible, which means that if we all would get it, right? And if we all got it simultaneously or pretty short order, we would crash our entire healthcare system. So that's really the biggest reason to keep everybody at home was to slow the spread until we either figured out how to get a vaccine or treatments or whatever. But imagine if, in this case, say, even 10% of our population was going to get severe disease, and that severe disease was enough to put them in the hospital or at least in the healthcare system, then what that means is that, you know, that's 30 million people. That's a lot of people to be in our healthcare system simultaneously. So the idea was, since everybody's susceptible and there's a number of individuals who would get ill, that we needed to slow the spread. And that's why, for the most part, for influenza, the number of people who get, you know, ill enough to go to the hospital, we understand what that number is. We have a sense of how many people that would be. COVID-19 would be on top of that. So the first order of business was to not crash the healthcare system, because not only would we not be able to care for COVID-19 patients, we we also would not be able to care for anyone else in that time, you know, during that time period. The second thing that's really important about locking down and social distancing is that the number of people that were dying were at a really high level, especially people who were much older. So the level of, or the death rate for people over 70, 75 is something like 15%. That's a fairly high mortality rate. And that's pretty darn scary. And I think that that's another reason to keep us all apart. So lots of susceptibility and a high mortality rate in the older population.
What about the school of thought that we should just let it run free and there's herd immunity? I guess, does that have any validity in terms of trying to get this disease under control?
Sure. And I'm going to say that as sarcastically as I can, because if the entire population, about 1.7% of the individuals who get infected will die. So in order to achieve herd immunity, we would essentially have to let 30-something million people die, almost, or 3 million, almost 6 million people would have to die in our country alone just to achieve herd immunity. So that's point one. Let's not sacrifice 6 million people just because we don't want to wear a mask. I think that's probably pretty reasonable. Also, the other problem is that in order for herd immunity to really be successful, you need to become immune and stay immune for a long period of time. And there's some instances in which the antibodies or the immunity of this particular virus seem to be waning over time. Now, how long that is dependent on individuals, and it seems to be, you know, variable, but it's not lifelong. So we're not immune to this virus forever. And some people will continue to be getting sick. So maybe the number of people who'd have to get ill in order to cause herd immunity is closer to 90% of our population. And that might not be achievable if the immunity fades over time. So there's two reasons to think that this probably won't. It's not my favorite idea to let the virus run free.
Yeah, I think we'll have a lot of heartbreak.
Yes.
Really change people. So how is transmitted the coronavirus?
So the coronavirus is transmitted primarily through respiratory droplets. And all that means is it replicates a lot of different places in the body. But the place that it seems to replicate the most is in the nasopharynx, which is essentially just the back of your throat and in your sinuses. And because that is a nice, warm, gooey, mucousy place, every time you talk and you generate saliva and mucus, and as you talk, you generate respiratory droplets, and the virus travels in these very warm, wonderful, gooey messes that you spew out every time you're talking, shouting, singing, coughing, sneezing. And that's how the virus gets out into the air, and then someone else will breathe them in. I think this is a moment in time when a lot of people are suddenly realizing how yucky we all are because we're spewing all these things and breathing them in. And every time that has been happening our entire lives. And it's now a little bit to the forefront that we are sharing all kinds of microorganisms with each other all the time.
Yeah. And I've read some places, you know, there was a particular post on one of the pages, someone that was really critical about mask wearing, where they say that the particle of coronavirus is smaller than the holes in the mask. And so it would be inconsistent in preventing transmission. Is there any validity to that, or?
Well, it's assuming that the masks are there to protect the wearer of the mask. Mm-hmm. The mask is there to protect everyone else. So think about it this way. When you go to the hospital and everybody is wearing a mask, they're wearing a mask to protect the sick. They're not wearing a mask so that they don't get what you have. That doesn't work that way. Masks don't work that well. If you want to see somebody protect themselves from other people, they are wearing full goggles and face shields and all kinds of things. The mask is not to protect the wearer. It does a little bit, and I think it's appropriate to say that if you're wearing a mask, you're more protected than you would be if you weren't, but it doesn't protect you the way that you think of, oh, it doesn't work, you know, because I could still get sick if I wear a mask. The mask, if you think about it, the mask is covering your mouth and nose, and your mouth and nose are actually quite narrow openings. If you think about it in comparison to the mask, you know, goes up on your cheeks. Well, the viral droplets are, the respiratory droplets are coming out of your mouth in a fairly small space and almost directly into the mask, which is right in front of them. Now, those respiratory droplets are much, much bigger than the virus itself. And so they get trapped in that mask. And that's what's important. So that's very close contact. And it's very, very small surface area between your mouth and the mask. But if you're not wearing a mask and you spew respiratory droplets out into the air, they're everywhere and they're going to get in your eyes and they're going to get between the mask and around it because you're being bombarded from a much greater space than you would be if, in terms of, you know, if you switch it around and it's you spewing respiratory droplets into the mask. So in that way, it really is just to remind yourself that it isn't about you. It's not about the wearer. It's never about the wearer. And, you know, when I talk to people, particularly on TikTok, you know, the way that I walk around the world is I assume that everyone is infected and everyone is spewing respiratory droplets. And if they're not wearing a mask, I'm going to be more than 6 feet away from them. And I recognize that to protect myself, I have to stay 6 feet away from everyone else, not think that, you know, it is a very selfish space, I think, to expect that. Well, if it's not protecting me, then it's not doing any good. It's like, yeah, it is doing good, just not necessarily for you.
And I think what may have been confusing, because now that you've explained it, it kind of opened up my mind a bit more, because I thought that it was protecting everybody. And my think is like, so because there was a turn about when we were told not to wear masks and that it didn't really protect the wearer of the mask. But now have you explained it, that never has changed. It's just because we have to protect everybody else. And so we're working under the assumption that everybody has the virus. And so the less respiratory droplets are in the air, the easier it is, the more safe everybody is. That's what
exactly.
I got. And
yes.
So there was never an about face say at all. So that would be an incorrect assumption just to think that way. So
yeah, it was a little bit of a conspiracy theory to throw out the fact that we were worried about the hospital workers and healthcare workers that wouldn't have enough masks. Mm-hmm. And so the idea that the general public would have to wear masks suddenly would make it so that there were no masks for people who actually needed them to survive. And so at first it was like, hey, maybe the public shouldn't be wearing masks until we make sure that everybody who needs them has the appropriate personal protective equipment or PPE. But even so, it's because wearing a mask doesn't protect the wearer. And so it's like, that doesn't actually help you.
Yeah. So let's go into possible treatments of what can we do to help. There are some thoughts about holistic ways of preventing COVID-19, such as like increasing your vitamin D and making a strong immune system. Can a strong immune system prevent coronavirus infection?
So I will start with a disclaimer. This disclaimer is that I'm not a physician and okay. I don't think about treatment very much.
Yeah.
But I will talk about the immune system and how it works.
Okay.
So vitamin D is an important component of your everyday nutrition and you need to have it. There are some papers out there that describe that people who are deficient in vitamin D are showing worse symptoms from coronavirus. So those two things are true, but there's no evidence to suggest that taking extra vitamin D is going to change the course of your infection. It's just if you were vitamin D deficient, you would have a worse course of the infection. Okay, so that's been shown. Now I want to get back to this idea of a stronger immune system. The reason that people feel sick is because their immune system is doing its job. You cannot boost your immune system by eating differently or eating a particular thing or whatever. Your immune system is going to do its job just as it does its job. It doesn't need you to make it stronger. The things that make your immune system weaker are things like stress, lack of sleep, lack of proper nutrition, lack of appropriate calories. Generalized health is what's going to keep your immune system as strong as possible. You want your immune system to work appropriately, and that's more important than trying to figure out what supplements you can take to make it stronger. And I use air quotes there because that's not a thing. And by the way, if your immune system is overactive, I'm not going to use the term stronger, but if your immune system overreacts, that's actually very dangerous for human beings. Our immune system is kind of working on this razor's edge of responding appropriately and not killing you. The reason that people get very, very ill from infectious disease is not because of the infectious disease agent. It is because your immune system is responding to that infectious disease agent. And your response, the immune response, if there's some way that the infectious agent, like SARS-CoV-2, can stay around for longer or hide from the immune system a little bit or make it, you know, so that the immune system is tricked in some way, well, that's just going to require the immune system to work harder and bring out the heavier artillery, which makes you feel more ill. And so the idea of you strengthening your immune system is kind of a, you know, it's a non-starter. Your immune system is what it is. And to make it work appropriately and effectively, you should not make it worse. And making it worse is by adding in essentially stress hormones. Is the easiest way to suppress your immune system is to be stressed. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that is really important to think about when you go to get a vaccine, for example, is you need a lot of really good sleep and you shouldn't be stressed because your immune response is going to be best if you are not stressed.
Oh, fantastic. I didn't know that. So let's talk about what makes some people get really sick and some people don't. I mean, what would be the reason for that? What would trigger different immune responses, essentially, is what I'm asking.
Brilliant question. So there's actually two really interesting ways of thinking about this. There is the sort of mechanical way, which is how many viruses you get in is going to dictate how many cells get infected, and how many cells get infected is going to dictate how hard your immune system has to work in order to get rid of that infectious agent. That's pretty straightforward. And there's lots of things that can modulate how many viral particles get into your cells and cause an infection. For example, there is some evidence that your blood type can change the conformation of the ACE2 protein, which is the protein that is on our cells that allows the virus to get in. And that little bit of a change can make it easier for the virus to get in or harder for the virus to get in. And so that modulates how many viruses infect your cells. That's one way to think about it. There also is a little bit of data about the mumps, having mumps antibodies in your bloodstream seems to decrease the number of viral particles that get into your cells and seems to give you some protection because you have fewer viral particles getting into your cells. You could have fewer ACE2 proteins on the surface of your cells, which means that you have fewer opportunities for the viruses to get into your cells, fewer viruses in your cells, less infection. So there's a number of things that can modulate how many viral particles get into your cells and cause an infection. So that's the mechanical space. On the genetic space, we were all genetically different. And in fact, our genetics, our immunological genetic differences are so rare that there's only about 7 to maybe 20 or so people on the entire planet who have an exact immunological match to us. So we all have a slight difference in our genetic makeup, which gives us a slight genetic difference when we have an immune response. And on top of that, our cells are constantly reinventing themselves, our immune cells. And in doing that, we're always looking to have the most diverse population of T cells, and in those are immune cells. And in having that diversity, sometimes the diversity does not include a cell that can recognize that particular virus in that particular moment in that day. So it takes a little bit of time. So there's all of this complexity that drives the differences amongst humans. And on top of that, there is the prior experience of some people have had not the exact same coronaviruses, but similar enough coronaviruses that provides a little bit more protection.
Yeah.
So prior experience, genetics and mechanics, it all gives rise to this incredible spectrum of disease.
All right. So I'm going to wrap up that part of the interview with Dr. Tracy. We're going to continue on this to the second part of the podcast. Thank you.